This is recording now, side number two on this tape. All right, now, Tom Mayhar, and what is your name, son?
Clayton Bowers.
Clayton Bowers?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. You talk clear. Don't talk like there's mush in your mouth, because when you're recording, it'll sound like you're 400 miles away.
Okay.
Now, this is a Steelman tape recorder, and I've taken 5 years of tapes on this now for the Pioneers. Mm-hmm. And I make a transfer tape off of this occasionally, and I carry this in the car when I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. And I put my memorandum notes, or if I interview anybody, I just turn it on and take it on the tape recorder.
Let me ask you something. Have you ever interviewed somebody with that recorder, recording the conversation with them not being aware of the fact that they were going on tape?
No, I've never taken secret tapes, although there's been a couple of times when somebody's been inebriated. I've had it, I mean.
In other words, they were talking under the influence.
That's right. I did that. And over at the hospital, I used to take this to the hospital, and it was one fellow. I have a long microphone for it. I hand him the mic, and he throwed it down. And he says, "I don't want that thing," and he went ahead and talked, and had it turned on. And of course, a little later, I stopped and played it back to him. He sure got a kick out of an old timer sick, you see. But he didn't know I had him. And then after I had him, it was all right.
Yes.
Now I'm recording again here at about medium volume, and we'll see what this sounds like now. The sudden noise is me tapping the sensitivity of it. That was a test tape. Now I've set the recorder here, and I'm going to... this is high, medium, low. Now it's low, high, medium, high. Now we'll see what that... One, two, three, four, five, six. The background is a radio, wagon train. Now, Tom Snip, this tape recorder is a Steelman, and I paid $214 with the power pack to run it on AC. Okay, this is AC operated as well as battery. It's on batteries right now. But all you do is plug this in the back and put it over an auxiliary on the switch and use it for save your batteries when you're in the home or in the office. See, that's the purpose of it. Now, I've got it recording right now, the same as if you're packing it around, see? And it isn't quite as clear as if you're going to record somebody with the button on them, but it picks up clear across the room. Tom, here I'm walking through the door in the other room, and that's going on the tape now, you see? And my only reason for selling this is that I got too much stuff to pack, and I got me a little tiny one to replace it, see? Now, Tom, I'm going to stop this. And then turn that knob till it goes clear over into the locked position. Now, Tom, it's recording now. Now, you talked like you was going to put a memorandum. You went to the co-op and eat at breakfast. You go ahead and talk now, so you'll see what you say.
Oh, well, that's all right. I can just say a few words.
Who'd you have with you to breakfast? I want to get your voice on that.
Oh, you mean for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had Howard Rock and Colleen, my
Who
sister.
Who is Colleen?
Colleen's my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry.
She's a nice-looking girl.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, fun. Now, Tom, I wanted to get your voice on there. I want to get in an argument with you, see? you're going to get a promotion recently, very shortly here, into a new job. And you're going to have to get on the ball and lead people out. You're going to have to be a leader.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Hi, this is May 16th, 1964, at Fairbanks, Alaska. And I'm in the Nordell Hotel, visiting with an old-time pioneer friend, Oliver Anderson. He was born here in the early days, and he's a native Alaskan. And Miss Alaska Lake, formerly Alaska Moody, has been after me to get a story from Mr. Anderson for some time. So This morning I'll try to get a little of his history.
No, Oliver, you just go ahead and talk in a normal voice and tell me where you're born and the birth date and a few things about yourself.
Well, my father, being a marine engineer, shipped out of San Francisco for the Alaska Fish and Guano Plant at Killisnoo, Alaska in 1881. That's a subsidiary of the Hudson's Bay Company. And they came up on a tugboat called the Favorite. And a few years later, they moved to Treadwell. My mother came up in 87 from San Francisco. And I was born in 88. As an old native lady, took care of my mother when I was born. There was two doctors on the Juneau side, but too rough to get across the channel. So there wasn't much happened during those few years there, but my friend Frank Schotter and I were on the Treadwell dock. We were about 7 years old. We were on the Treadwell dock when the steamer Willapaw landed on her first trip in competition with the big Pacific Steamship Company. The fare was originally $25, and the Willapaw cut the rate to $10.
$10,
yeah. And with the Willapaw being on the run, the big Pacific Steam had several other vessels on, and they couldn't meet the cut until winter, when they only had one boat on, and they met the cut. I was there in Douglas during the Klondike Rush in 1898-99. There was hundreds and hundreds of boats came by. One in particular was the Clara Nevada, formerly the Hassler. The Hassler was a revenue cutter for the government service. And she was condemned and then bought by some company to operate the Klondike Rush. She passed through Juneau about February 1899, and all the rats left the boat. So when the rats left the boat, the sailors all quit. They shipped a new crew. And she went on to Skagway and left Skagway the next night, on her way back, and at Eldred Rock, about 25 miles or 30 miles below Skagway, she struck the rocks and blew up. My sister was on the beach at Burners Bay, about 15 miles away when it happened.
Can you give her a name?
And my sister's name was Elvina Morrow. And the light, the whole sky lit up. They heard the explosion. The water blew up. Now everybody on that boat was lost. There was one body discovered quite a while afterwards, that of the purser. That was all. That was the end of the Clara Nevada. And I was in Douglas, 1901. The steamer Islander left Skagway 9 p.m. August 14th, and hit the rocks, around the point of Gas New Channel the next morning at 2:15. Well, she didn't hit the rocks, she hit an iceberg, I should say. There was a loss of 42 lives. It's been said that there were 72 lives, but at that time it was 42. And I happen to know all about it, because in those days the kids used to ride up from Douglas to Treadwell free on the ferry boat. And we come into Treadwell that morning about 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and there was a lifeboat from the steamer Islander that was there. It was the mate of the boat and some sailors, and a fellow named Billy Mullen, a vaudeville actor from Dawson, was on that lifeboat. They came out and told us about the wreck, and this boat that I went on to Treadwell, the steamer Flosey, went on down to see what could be done. And they picked up bodies and so on after that.
And that was what year?
That was 1901, August 15th. The channel was as smooth as glass, but a dense fog. Now it's been said, that's right, by Billy Mullen, now how authentic this is. Billy Mullen was an vaudeville actor, and he was playing poker at the time the boat struck. says they dashed up on deck. They were down below. And Billy says that he told himself that he could see the trees close by there. Billy always said that she struck the rocks. Now that's just hearsay. Mm-hmm. He told me that himself. But her captain committed suicide. He was saved. He was on a raft. He lit his pipe and jumped in the bay.
After the disaster.
Yeah, after the disaster. And there was the pilot was on watch. He wasn't on duty. You see, the captain wasn't. He wasn't on duty when it happened, and the pilot was on the bridge, and he lost his license for good, and he was later postmaster of the city of Victoria for a good many years. And I don't know of another of a soul alive today that was on that boat outside of Sam Applebaum was the last one I know of, and he died about 2-3 years ago. He was a passenger, came out from Dawson. Now it was also reported that the Clara Nevada had a lot of gold on her. It was long in February, and she wouldn't have any gold that time of the year. Now it was also reported that the Islander had a lot of gold on, but the only gold that was on the Islander was the pokes that these miners had themselves. There was nothing in the safe. Later, I stayed in Douglasson a few years, and in 1907, there was four of us kids took a notion to go to the interior. We left Douglas on the steamer Dolphin in May 1907 at the Skagway, and we flipped the coins to see which kid rode the train. The kid that rode the train, the other three had to put in $5 apiece towards his fare because he took their baggage over, and the other three kids walked and one fellow rode the train. I happened to be lucky and rode the train.
You got the train.
We got into Whitehorse, and we bought a Yukon boat, a rowboat, and we had a number put on by the police. They always number the boats. And we started on down the river. We got to head of Lake LaBarge, and we pulled our boat up on the ice and waited until about 2 in the morning until it was freezing, see? And we pulled the boat over the ice. It had runners on it then. Pulled it for 30 miles across there, and we got in the river, a 30-mile river. And we were supposed to make our first stop at Hootalinqua and report to the police station.
Now, can you hold it there a second? I want to check the tape now.
Put it like in the barge is where they cremated Sam McGee. Is that in there?
Yeah.
Where they cremated Sam McGee. We checked in at Hootalinqua, and our next check-in station was at Selkirk. Although there was other stations down the river, when we'd pass by, the police had put their glasses on us to check our numbers. And if we checked out with four people in a boat, and they could only see three, later on you were called in.
Had
accounting for the other man. And that way they did catch some murders up in the Yukon. And we got into Dawson on the Queen's birthday, right, May 24th. Of course, that night, we wasn't supposed to be in the dance hall, but we went there anyway.
You was kids, but you went to hall.
We were big kids. Mm-hmm. They asked us our ages, though. And of course, we were 21. 19, but we told them we were 21.
Do you remember any of the people when you went in that dance hall? Do you remember any of them today?
No, I don't. In the dance hall there, I remember sitting there watching the show. You see, they used to have Orpheum Circuit Waterville on there.
That's right.
I was watching the show, and it was a couple of big shots up in the box buying champagne for a couple of girls, and they spilled some on a fellow sitting down below. And he got up and squawked about it, and they threw him $50 down and said, "Buy yourself a new suit." Well, I went over there and sat down the rest of the evening.
You're waiting for you to get that suit.
Well, I didn't get anything thrown on me, so I didn't do so good. Well, they had wonderful music in those days, in those places. Now, in this dance hall, Professor Premuth, that was later in Yakima for a good many years and took quite an interest in the Pioneer Organization, was the leader of the orchestra, and a fellow named Ed Fawcett was the second violinist. And one of the Douglas boys was a trombone. One of them was trap drums. The others, I don't remember the names of. And they had a fellow named Swartz was the MC in the middle of the floor. I could still hear him. Actually, I could still hear him. 50 beautiful ladies to select from. The next number will be the preacher and the bearer. Everybody dance. I can still hear them.
As a kid, I remember that music.
Yeah, sure. So I stayed in the old principal hotel. I think it's still standing there. I stayed there, and I paid the big sum of $1 a day for my room. It was high-priced stuff then. And the other boys with me went to a 50-cent bunkhouse. But I happened to have the money when I had $25. So I stayed in the principal hotel because B.M. Behrens, the banker in Juneau, told me before I left, Oliver, always go to a good place to stay in. He says, you'll meet good people, too.
That's right.
He says, you don't meet them in joints. Mm-hmm. Well, so I stayed there, and I got a job on the steamer Hamilton, NAT&T boat. A fellow named John Campbell was a Scotchman, Scotch mate, was on her. Captain Douglas and Kid Marion was the pilot. Well, he died only a few years ago. And got on that boat for St. Michael. Then St. Michael about 2 weeks and helped unload the Lyra. She had 5,000 tons of freight for up the river, a big ocean ship. Then I got a job on the Oil City, but for Fairbanks, deckhand. Captain Depew was on her. A man named George Matheson was mate. Trot was chief engineer. And Cream Puff Bill was the cook. Of course, I remember Cream Puff Bill better than any of them because he was such a wonderful cook. And every meal was like a Christmas dinner on that boat, which was true. So we got up to Fairbanks. We landed in Chena first. We started to unload the boat. I remember we got 2.5 a day as deckhands. And we had to work alongside a longshoreman that was getting $1 an hour. So we all quit. And we walked in. I walked into Fairbanks. On the 5th of July, I got in here at midnight. The first place I went to was the Florodora Dance Hall.
That was on the 5th of July, 1907.
1907, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Florodora Dance Hall. So they had wonderful music there. Vic Durand just passed away a few years ago here. It was the leader of the orchestra, and it was dance music. I remember a girl came out to me and she says, kid, I want to dance. I said, no, I don't dance. And she came back again and says, I know you do. So finally I got up to dance. I stayed here 10 days in Fairbanks and got rid of all my money. Then I went up to Dawson. I got a job from Andy Livingston, was the first mate of the steamer Lavelle Young. By the way, the Lavelle Young was the first boat ever into Fairbanks, too.
It was?
Captain Adams brought her.
I knew Andy Livingston.
Yeah, Andy Livingston hired me as deckhand.
I was
in Dawson. And then I got a job on the Selkirk, the deckhand, going to Whitehorse. Then I went longshore until the middle of October at Whitehorse, and then went home. And that was my experience on that trip.
Well, while you were around Dawson, about that time, do you remember any incident or anything of significance that might be factual for history?
No, I don't.
For instance, they brought Hatfield the Rainmaker up there. Do you remember that?
Yes, well, that was before my time.
Just before your
time. Yes, well, I remember it. I was in Douglas Island when they
Well, that's a true thing. They did bring Hatfield from Los Angeles to San Francisco.
Very true. Brought him up.
And he couldn't make it rain.
No, he didn't make it.
And after he left, it poured and poured and poured.
Yeah.
Well,
and he tried to claim credit for it.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't try that.
But do you remember the story about the chief of the Mahannies, that his medicine man was around politicking to try to get that job?
No, I don't.
To make it rain?
No, I don't.
No.
chief of the Indians then was Chief Isaacs.
Chief Isaacs, that's right. Do you remember any of the old miners over there?
Not in Dawson, no.
You see, George Bajonics was there till 1950. He left there in 1950.
I didn't remember any of these.
And Alfred Gadsley left there in 1905, and Bob Bloom in 1903.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was first there in 1907. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I went back to judo, and in 1910 I took in the Iditarod Stampede. We came in on the train to Whitehorse and then on the rowboat down the same way we did before. But with that trip, I went all the way to Tanana, left the rowboat there, and I went on the steamer Martha Clough from Tanana to Iditarod. And slept on the beach all night waiting for the boat to come in. In those days, that's the way we took care of ourselves. And we were all healthy anyway. And I went aboard the boat and I says, "Captain, what is the fare to Iditarod?" And I was very polite in those days. I even took my hat off. Well, he says, "Kid, it's $50 first class and 42nd. Well, I said, "I'll take first class ticket." All right. Well, I waited until we got out of town hall to ask him about a berth. After we left there, I went up to him and I said, "Captain, who will assign a berth to me and also a meal seat?" Well, he said, "Kid, you'll have to see the cook." So I went to the cook. I said, "You the cook on here?" "You know, I'm trying to do the job." Well, I said, "I have a first class ticket for Iditarod, and the captain said you would assign me a berth and also a meal seat." Well, he says, "Kid, we have no berths around here. Any place you can flop is all right with me."
That was first class.
As far as a meal seat's concerned, you have the fifth sitting. So see, we have 60 passengers on the boat and only room for 12 at the table. Well, the first night I flopped underneath the dining room table trying to sleep, but then they started a poker game. Been now, I'd be in it. So I didn't get any rest. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, they got me out of there. And I was getting pretty tired, no place to rest. So I moved out with a barge of 6 or 8 head of horses on. And I moved out there and slept in the hay. And the second day out, the captain was around collecting fares from those that had gone out of town hall, but he'd already got me. So I saw him collecting 40 from some and 30 from others, but nobody paid 50. So I went up to him, went up to his office, and I still took off my hat and talked to him. I said, "Captain, I think you made an error in my fare." He said, "How's that, kid?" I said, "Well, you charged me $50. I saw you collecting fares down there. Some paid you 40, some paid you 30, but nobody paid you 50. Why, that's easy to explain, my boy. Those that paid 40 are second-class passengers. Those that paid 30, that's all they had. You paid 50, you're a first-class passenger." I says, "Fine, I always did want to ride first class." Well, that's the way I went to Iditarod. I got into the water business in Iditarod.
That's delivering water from house to house.
Water, yeah, with a yoke across my back.
Mm-hmm.
25 and 50 cents a bucket. I was in partners with Black Sullivan, an old-time moonshiner. We got $1 a day for the use of the pump, and we had 11 resters carrying their own water. We got $1 a day anyway.
But wouldn't they laugh at that today?
Yeah.
Well, it was the same when I come to the country. We did whatever we had.
Sure.
Oh, how did you get the news of this Iditarod Stampede?
Oh, well, that was spread all over the country.
Is there runners or grapevine or travelers to give it to you?
Yeah, sure.
There's no other way to get news.
Iditarod was struck in 1909. Mm-hmm. You see, and this is spring of 10 when the big stampede was on.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the steamer Martha Clough was a Fairbanks boat, owned by George Finger. Very fine fellow, too.
Well, some of his relations still in the country.
Yes.
Yes, I met some. Now, what do you remember about the Purdy's?
The Purdy's and 40 Mile.
Yeah.
You know, all I knew was Purdy's first, when he was agent for the NC Company at New Lato. Mm-hmm. I didn't see him afterwards. I haven't seen him. Is he living yet?
Well, there's part of the family living.
Yeah.
They're still living up in that chicken country.
Well, he was agent for the NC Company at New Lato.
Wasn't there some other exciting stampedes and some things went on here that you can remember about?
Well, I went to the Ruby Stampede in 1911.
Did you ever try your hand at mining?
Well, I prospected, never mining.
You never made anything that way. You had to work for it, like most of us.
I prospected. I prospected in Ruby and up in the Keokuk. Yeah, I got into Ruby. I came up from my Iditarod to Ruby with Alabama Laboito. Alabama Laboito used to be out here at the Livengood. And he came along with an open boat by Dykeman, and he said, get on. So I got on. And we started for the Indian River Stampede up at the Keokuk. We got to New Lato, we found out it was a fake, so we went on up to Ruby. And I slept on the deck of the old barge in Nebraska. 12 or 15 of us slept on the deck there for about 2 weeks, I guess, until a boat came along and towed it away, and we had to go ashore.
Did you have an opportunity any time to hear about any of these robberies or murders or things that have been embellished a little as time went on?
Well, you asked me something now that I know a little about.
Yeah.
In 1912, September 12th, 1912, I remember dates, you know. September 12th, 1912, Dutch Marie, Fiddler John, I can't think of the other fellow's name, came down from Wiseman to catch the steamer Reliance to go to the Yukon. They got to Battles a day too late. She'd already gone. See, there was no telegraph communication then, you know. So they hired Blueberry Tommy, a little Englishman that had a gas boat called the Seal Pup. They hired him to take them to the Yukon. The navigation was still open on the Yukon. So he started out of Wiseman for the Yukon. So his folks, Fiddler John's folks, I believe, rode in. They never heard from him. See, there was no communication. I know I had mail service only once a month. Didn't hear. They knew that they left up there. So this is in 1914. I was at Ruby, and I was with working with Johnson and Jepson, and I was in with Pete Johnson in this a little steamer. And we traded up the Keokuk River. We used to trade up as far as Hughes, selling to the natives and the miners at Indian River. And before we left, Captain Donovan, a former deputy marshal, who used to be in Iditarod, came in and he came over to me and he said, "All right, here you're going up the Keokuk." I said, "Yes, I'm going up with Pete Johnson in a couple of days." He says, "I'd like to go with you, I'll pay my fare." Well, I said, "Cap, we have no license to carry passengers. So I can't collect anything from you." And he said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll pay my expense of the food." I said, "All right, come along." He says, "Down at Keokuk, I'm going to take on another passenger." All right, so we got to Keokuk, and he took an Indian with him there at Keokuk, and a small boat. Took that along with us. We went up the river. I was 50 or 60 miles up, I guess. The Indian pointed in there. See, so we landed and put them off. That's where they found the remains of these people. See? All three had been killed, shot, and then burned up. The remains were there. They camped for the night at that place, and he killed them all and robbed them. And then he buried his boat in the slough there in the sand, the boat called the Seal Pup. he went down to New Lado on a raft, saying that he was wrecked up the river and he just barely got out. Never mentioned the other people on there because nobody in New Lado knew they were on. And he caught the steamer J.P. Light at New Lado for St. Michael. He caught the Victoria at St. Michael on her last trip for Seattle. And the last heard from him, he was heard about him. He was in the Army, the British Army, 1914 or 15.
First World War.
Yeah, but they never did catch him.
Never did catch him. Well, that's another mystery for Alaska history.
I wrote a story on that for the Daily Dispatch in Juneau.
They used to tell me they had some wrestling and boxing matches. Do you remember any of that?
Well, they used to have in Dawson. Nick Burley was the champion, and George Slavin. They were all both fighters there in the early days.
Have you been to Dawson in recent years?
I haven't been to Dawson since 1926.
1926. Well, there's very few alive over there, but there might be a half a dozen or so that knows all about the country at that time. Now that man that you just mentioned on there, that wrestler, boxer, his name was Frank Slavin.
Frank Slavin and Nick Burley.
Well now, Oliver, I want to ask you a little bit of your early life around Fairbanks and some of your experiences. You knew from everybody here.
Well, I never lived in Fairbanks very long, very much.
Well, you was in and out.
In and out, yeah.
Well, what was some of the bigger towns or villages when these stampedes went on? Now, for instance, like Eagle and Circle and I did, Rodney, how many people was in those areas?
Well, I wasn't in Circle in the early days. I didn't go to Circle until 1924, and I was there until 1927, but I was in and out of there, though, before.
Well, that's when the town shrunk up. There wasn't
there. Hardly any. Mm-hmm. And one thing in Circle, they had the biggest, Circle at one time was the biggest log cabin town in the world.
It was?
Yeah.
That's an important thing.
Sure. And the show house there was built by George T. Snow. They went from Juneau to 40 Mile and then to Circle, and they built a show house in Circle. Built of logs. That was a big place also.
And none of those buildings are standing today?
No. That show house was used for a good many years for a barn.
Now, can we jump back down to where you were raised and tell us a little about the Treadwell Mine, the richest mine in Alaska at that time?
Well, I was selling papers in those days.
Well, do you remember much about it?
Oh, I remember everything about it.
See, I was a kid, too, pretty young at that time.
How old are you now?
I'm 65. I'll be 66 next birthday.
Just a kid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, my father was an engineer at the Treadwell Mine, a stationary engineer. And I remember everything about it. All you have to do is ask me.
Can you volunteer this? About the mine, there was a world publicity on the production of gold there, and how many men there were hired. And what caused the accident?
Well, there was four mines there. There was the Treadwell Mine was the first one to be started. That's where they had the big glory hole.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mine just below called the 700. And the one below the 700 was the Mexican mine, then the Ready Bullion, four of them. Well, the Treadwell Mine got too close to the top, and that's where they caved in.
The bay broke in.
Mm-hmm. But the Ready Bullion Mine was saved because in the meantime they thought of that for some time before it happened. They figured it might come. So they filled up all those tunnels so the water couldn't get into the Ready Bullion. And the Ready Bullion Mine, it was all the mining in the Ready Bullion Mine was under the water, every bit of it.
Oh, it was.
There was nothing that wasn't under the water. The shaft was on an incline.
Was that a rock formation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On an incline. Mm-hmm. So all that was all
I don't remember very much as a kid, but I thought you would. Do you remember how many men they had there?
Well, at one time there was about 1,400 people employed by the mines.
The four mines.
Yeah.
Now, there was there any small prospectors that made any money there in the early days?
No.
It was all company money.
Well, there was one thing the Treadwell Mine did do. Is a good many men got a grub stake working there and went to Dawson.
Oh.
Part of the Gold Stampede.
Did you know Merle Thomas down there very well?
Oh, yes, very well.
Well, what can you tell me? Now, I visit with Merle all the time, and if you don't mind, I let him hear this afterwards, and he can add some more stories.
Merle is a great friend of mine.
Mm-hmm. I should have taken and got him with you today.
Earl came up to the country. His father was an undertaker by trade.
Yeah.
And he was also, he handled sheet metal, but windows, glass, and all that kind of stuff
mm-hmm.
there in Douglas.
Station doors.
Yeah, I knew the folks very well. I knew Merle Thomas's wife Agnes very well too.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Merle the other night. The first thing he says, "How are you, Doc?"
Mm-hmm. Well, now you tell that. How do you come to be called Doc?
Well, there was how I happened to be called Doc. There was an old druggist came down from Dyea, Dr. Huebner. And of course, I was always looking for a job on Saturday, and went and asked Doc for a job, and he said, "I don't have any money, son, but you can have a job." Well, I said, "That's all I'm looking for is a job." I used to wash the windows for him and scrub the floor every Saturday and run his errands. And that's how I got the nickname of Doctor and all the other kids. And I'm called that by a lot of old timers today.
Then you, in your life, you've did quite a number of jobs.
Yeah, Robert McKenna, that we used to be, that's passed on.
Mm-hmm.
We were raised together in Douglas.
He was known as Bob McKenna.
Yeah,
Mickey McKenna.
Mickey. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Mickey.
I didn't get any stories from Bob. He was shy of these recorders. And I've got to kind of go easy on some of them. I've got some awful good stories here that they don't want used for so many years.
Yeah.
Alaska Link is president of the auxiliary here, formerly Alaska Moody, and she wanted to be sure that I got the story from you. And she was amazed when she found that I had you yesterday out at the university district.
Oh,
yeah. Now you can, if you can, give us a little highlight into your visit with these Mr. Bill Cashin and Earl Weisslein.
Well, Earl was... Billy Cash was born right across the street from us in Douglas. His grandparents and his mother and dad are all great friends of ours. It was kind of just one big family around Douglas in those days. They had to be.
Survival.
Yeah.
And what part did you remember about Earl Weisslein?
I didn't remember him so well. But I knew him well, but I didn't remember much about him because I was away from there for quite a while.
Do you remember anything about Mr. Galen?
Galen?
Mm-hmm.
Jim Galen?
Jim Galen.
Oh, I knew him. He used to be in Cordova. He had the Alaska transfer. Yeah, I knew him very well.
Did you know any of his help? Did you know little Johnny Hard that lives at Lignite?
No, I didn't.
But did you know Bobby Sheldon down there?
Oh, very well. I knew Bobby down in Skagway. And I first met Bobby down at Douglas. He was an engineer and a pile driver. That's way back in 1904.
Oliver, sometime a little later, when you refresh your memory a little and you'd like to talk a little more, I'd be glad to take another short stretch on here. I should have had this yesterday with us, and I want to personally thank you for the pioneers for the little information you've given us, and Hope you can come back a lot of years to visit us here in Fairbanks.
Hope so, too.
Now, I want to get your correct name, spell it out, and your correct address, so that...
Oliver Anderson.
O-L-I-V-E-R, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N.
Yeah.
And you live at...
2474. Dexter Avenue North.
Dexter Avenue North.
Seattle, Washington.
Do you have any relation or any family there?
No, no family.
You're all alone, are you?
Maybe my wife. My wife.
Your wife's there, yeah. Now, I would like to ask you also, what year you joined the Pioneers of Alaska, and what place?
Well, I joined in Ruby about 1912, I believe.
Joined Ruby at 1912.
Yeah, 1912.
Mm-hmm.
But I belong to the Seattle Lodge now.
Yukon Order, yeah, Alaska Yukon, yeah, Pioneers, yeah, yes.
Yeah.
You don't belong here now?
No.
Were you a life member at the time, or were you just a...
I don't remember.
You don't remember?
Yeah, I don't.
Well, this is little information for the historian.
All I remember is I was always on the committee for all their parties.
Well, you worked at it. Well, thank you for now, Oliver, and we'll let you rest, and you say you have an appointment. And this is Harry Hughes recording for Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska at Fairbanks, Alaska on May the 16th, 1964. And I thank you, Oliver.
Okay.
This is June the 29th, 1964 at Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is Harry Hughes and Bob Bloom, an old-timer here, preparing for a trip down to Paxton and Rika Wallen's place on the Big Delta River. So this is 10 minutes to 6 in the morning, and we're getting ready to leave. This is a beautiful day, and we're making good time here. Sun has been bright this morning. Beautiful sunshine here and the pretty wildflowers along the road. We've made Big Delta in about 2 hours and 15 minutes. There's been practically no traffic on the road, and now we're heading up towards the Donnelly Flats. And we haven't seen any sign of game, except some pet horses. Well, we stopped out here at the Donnelly campgrounds. And Bob and I have made a couple of sandwiches, and Bob brought along a little lunch, and I did too, and we've had hot coffee. So we're getting ready to start again. This campground's a beautiful place, and wonderful flowers here. There's several tourists in here. Now we're pulling out. Well, we're up here in the neighborhood of Slim Moore's Summit Lake Roadhouse. I think I see Slim Moore over there, yes? He's helping these folks that bought the place to get it restored. Bob and I stopped here a few minutes and filled with gas and took a couple of pictures. Now we're on our way to Paxton Lodge and Mary Jo's place. So, look ahead of us here. The road is all torn up here. When we get on the other end of this, I'll take some pictures. We're going on down to Mary Jo's now. Well, Bob's had quite a visit here with Mary Jo, and reminiscing about the farms in Idaho, and Bob's wife in Seattle and the kids. We're getting ready to go back, but Mary Jo brought out a couple of nice grayling here for Bob, and we're going to have a little grayling maybe when we get home. Well, I've stopped back here at this washout. This washout is a pretty big thing here. There's quite a few hundred feet of highway gone, just disappeared, and this ain't no earthquake. This is just high water from the Summit Lake area. I took a couple of pictures. Now we're on our way again. Well, we're on our way again, and we stopped a few minutes at George Norton's, and he took a book of tickets in Norton's liquor store at Big Delta for the goalpost raffle, and then we're on our way again. Well, now we got down here to Rika Wallens and John Hajdukovic. She seems to be highly pleased here. She's been showing us her furniture work and her painting, which she's done an awful good job of. She's made some odd chairs here. She She's made them with babiche, just like we used to make early day snowshoes, and this is really good. So she's painting them light colors. She's got very bright colors here. For a woman 90 years old, she sure is active. And we've had a little coffee and cake. And Rika sure has indicated she likes to hear from her old-timers and have them stop visit with her. Well, we're getting ready to leave again. Well, now we're heading across the Big Delta Bridge and up towards Richardson Roadhouse will probably be the next place we stop. And I stopped a few minutes at Richardson Roadhouse now. And Denise Albert was there, and she took a book of Gold Poke raffle tickets for the pioneers. And she's had me deliver a little message in town for her, so I'm on my way. Bob and I are heading back towards Fairbanks. Well, we're getting into town here now. Traffic's starting to thicken up for a change. We hadn't had any traffic all day, but now there's quite a string of cars up here. Well, I'm letting Bob Bloom out of the car at his house, and I'm going to go back towards home and deliver this message for Denise Albert. This is a trip by Harry Hughes and Bob Bloom to Paxson Lodge and Big Delta, the home of Rika Wallum and John Hajdukovich. We've had a swell day, and I'll say 30 for this end of this tape. This is June the 29th, 1964, at 8 o'clock in the evening at Fairbanks, Alaska. This is Harry Hughes recording.